Now, a lot of modern scholarship wants to derogate the notion that Matthew wrote Matthew, Mark wrote Mark, Luke wrote Luke, and John wrote John. But I think the burden of proof is on the revisionists, because as far back as you can go in church history, the idea was that Matthew was a disciple of Jesus. He wrote Matthew. Mark was a compatriot of Peter, and he wrote that gospel. Luke was a compatriot of who? Paul, because he's mentioned where? Book of Acts in the wee passages. Okay? Not the small passages, the passages where Luke talks about we did this and we were with Paul and so on. And John, the tradition is that this was the beloved disciple. Now you might say, well, wait a minute, they don't come out and say, I, Matthew, and so on. But you can still piece that together by looking at what they say internally. Nothing internally contradicts the traditional argument, traditional author argument. And really, you have to appeal to what could be called the principle of prescription. I talk about this in my book, Jesus in an Age of Controversy. I'm quoting a writer, fairly obscure writer, but it makes a very good point, a fellow named Cornelius Haggerty. Prescription is a process by which a right is acquired through long use. It is important for a lawyer to show a court on which side of a case lies the burden of proof. Now, it is an undisputed fact that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have been credited with being the authors of the gospel since the last quarter of the second century. That's the first record we have of it. The burden of proof is definitely on any modern scholar who contradicts this ancient tradition. Now, what you find in modern biblical criticism, higher criticism, is a lot of fanciful or a lot of, let's say, speculative reconstruction. C.S. Lewis, again, in that great essay, Modern Biblical Criticism, says that he doesn't really trust the modern critics of the Bible because he considers what they've done with his own work. So he reads interpretations of his own work and they just get it wrong all the time because they're finding hidden motives and secret themes. And he says they're so busy trying to read between the lines, they don't read the lines themselves. And you find this with higher criticism, where you're piecing things together and saying, well, this part is early and this part is late and this part was added at this time and cobbled together. And the burden of proof is really on the reconstruction, not on the original. Now, remember, the higher critics typically bring to the table methodological naturalism. So they just exclude miracle claims, however much it seems to be intrinsic to the narrative, and despite the fact that it doesn't read like fiction, legend, or myth. They just exclude them. And that's certainly very, very unfair. Let me skip down here. Another thing in terms of considering historicity is the presence of material that seems irrelevant to the early church. I mentioned that earlier. A lot of references to the kingdom of God and the teachings of Jesus, not that many in the later writings. Jesus' reference to himself as the Son of Man. You have distinctive features in the teachings of Jesus, such as his use of Abba, relating to God the Father in a very personal way, or his statements of Amen, 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 I say to you. This really singles out Jesus from other individuals at the time. And you find things that seem counterproductive on the surface. I've got a quote in On Jesus on page 16 from Will Durant, where he mentions things in the Gospels that seem a little embarrassing or strange or hard to figure out, such as Jesus saying, "Why do you call me good? No one is good but God alone." Or the depictions of the disciples as confused, or Peter even on the wrong side when it comes to the crucifixion, or things that don't fit really nicely and neatly into a contrived story. And in this case, Durant, Will Durant, in History of Civilization, who's not a believer, he says, because you have the presence of this kind of awkward and strange material, it's a mark of authenticity. Because it's kind of odd, it doesn't all fit together perfectly. You might think, well, that's a detriment. It's actually a benefit. Because if it is the writing of history, then we wouldn't expect everything to just fit together in some perfectly smooth narrative, because life just isn't like that. Lewis points this out in his essay as well, Modern Biblical Criticism. Okay. Also, you have to look at the time factor. Let me talk about Paul's letters. Paul's letters are written in the 50s AD. Now, there are some letters that are disputed, such as Ephesians and others. But if you take the ones that everybody believes were written by Paul, such as Romans, Galatians, and so on, then they're written in the 50s AD. Now, that's only 20 years after the departure of Jesus. And you find in Paul's letters a very richly developed Christology, particularly think of Philippians chapter 2. Being in the very form of God, he did not count equality with God something to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking on the form of a servant. Okay. Christ is the God-man who took on a human form and was slain, buried, and raised from the dead. That's written in the 50s. Okay, that's in Philippians. I think that's one of the undisputed books. But you have a high Christology in the Paul's corpus. And people, you know, say, well, you know, the situation is that John was written in the 90s, and by that time, he larded the historical accounts with a lot of mythological accretions. Because John is very theological. And Jesus gives longer, more metaphysically indulgent discourses. Very different than, let's say, Mark, that's kind of cut to the bone and things happen quickly. So it must be that John is adding things as kind of a posthumous compliment to his teacher. I say, wait a minute. Let's go back to Paul. Let's go back to Romans, 1 Corinthians, Philippians, and so on. You have an extremely high Christology there in the 50s, 20 years after the departure of Jesus. So you really can't use that argument. Now, one way you can date the outer limit of the Gospels is by considering their citation in non-biblical literature. So we find the vast majority of all the New Testament books quoted frequently in outside literature by the late first century. And you can reconstruct a good deal of the New Testament simply by citations in the Church Fathers. And if you can date them around 100 AD, then obviously the books are written before that. Right? So in that sense, you don't even have to worry about who the original authors were or when they were written. We know they were written not long after the events they describe. And as I said, given the principle of prescription and given no one has really definitively argued against Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John being the authors of their Gospels, we have a pretty strong argument for their historicity and reliability. Okay? Now let's talk about this dating argument with respect to Acts and Luke and Mark. I think this is a pretty powerful argument. The argument is that Luke precedes Acts. That's pretty clear from the texts. And that Luke used Mark. Now, I gave you a handout of the four-source synoptic situation. I took that from Craig Blomberg's book, Jesus and the Gospels. And I wonder if I kept one for myself or not. Can I take a look at that? Now, you'll get into this more if you haven't had New Testament survey yet. You will get a lot more details. But look at this now. We have Luke, and Luke, it's this one. Did everybody get this? Some people didn't. Do we have any extras in the back? We can. Can we get that there? All right, if you look at Luke, just add Acts before Luke. So Luke comes before Acts, and then Mark comes before Luke. And L is material distinctive to Luke, and M is material distinctive to Matthew. Q is German for source. This is a source. It's a supposed source. It's a conjecture. There's no Q document. But there are things that Matthew and Luke have in common that they don't take from Mark. So this is called Q. There's been a lot of speculation about Q. But in any event, what we're arguing here is that if we can date the book of Acts, then we can date Luke a little before it, and we can date Mark before that. Now, Blomberg doesn't think that Luke relied on Matthew. I believe Moreland thinks that's the case. That's disputable. We can just bracket that for the time being. So what you're trying to do is you're not giving one argument for the entire reliability of the New Testament. You don't have to do that with an unbeliever. You just say, look, let's give an argument for the reliability of one gospel or two gospels based on what we know from the book of Acts. And then you could say, well, would you read those materials? Would you read them if I give you an argument that they seem to be basically historically reliable? Will you take them seriously and consider the claims that are made within them? So we have an argument from the book of Acts. If we can date Acts and Luke, we can date Mark as earlier than Acts and Luke. And there's six arguments here. Now, this is based on what is not found in the book of Acts. Okay? Acts does not mention the fall of Jerusalem. And that, now, interestingly, that would apply to all the New Testament books. And so John A.T. Robinson, who cannot be accused of being a conservative, dated all the books of the New Testament as pre-70 AD, because none of them talk about the fall of Jerusalem. Now, the fall of Jerusalem was a titanic apocalypse in the ancient world, especially to the Jews. 70 AD, Jerusalem is destroyed by the Romans. Now, Jesus predicted this. He predicted it clearly. Matthew 24 and other passages. Now, how you handle that event in the relation to the end of the world is a vexed question. But I am sure that Jesus predicted the fall of Jerusalem. He predicted the fall of the temple. We know that. Okay. Now, it's interesting that none of the Gospels, no book in the New Testament mentions the fall of Jerusalem, but it does say that Jesus predicted that it would fall. Now, wouldn't you think that this would be a prime apologetic argument if it had already occurred? That it would find its way into the Gospels and into the book of Acts? So there, just by itself, is a very good argument, actually, for the entire New Testament being before 70 AD. But maybe that's too ambitious. Maybe that's too optimistic. Well, there are other considerations. I mean, there are other factors you need to look at. There is a strong sense among even the most conservative New Testament critics, historians, that John was probably written in the 90s. That's pretty much the consensus. For various reasons, reasons from church history and so on. Maybe this works. I'm not sure. But I just want to work with Acts and then Luke and Mark. There's no mention of Nero's persecution in the mid-60s. That would perfectly fit into the account in the book of Acts, the early church. There's no mention of the martyrdom of James, Paul, or Peter. Okay. Acts addresses subject matter that's clearly pre-70 AD, not post, other general terms. The terms used in Acts are very primitive. The Son of Man, Servant of God, first day of the week, the people, that fits the time before 70 AD. The Jewish war against the Romans is not mentioned. Now, this is not an argument from ignorance. It's an argument from conspicuous absence. So the argument looks like this. It's the denial of the consequent form, or modus tollens. If P, then Q, not Q, therefore not P. So if a date later than 70 AD for Acts, then very likely we would have facts 1 through 6. We don't have facts 1 through 6. Therefore, it's very likely that Acts was written, not written later than 70 AD. It's a pretty simple, straightforward argument. And if this argument works, you've got an early date for Acts, which records the events of the early church and the preaching of the early church and preaching Christ as the resurrected Lord. And you have an early date for Luke, and you have an early date for Mark. And if that 70 AD argument works, you've got the whole New Testament before 70 AD. I think, in fact, a good argument can be made on a variety of grounds for pre-70 AD for the Synoptic Gospels. John is a little harder. He may come more around 90 AD. But if John is the beloved disciple of Jesus writing late in his life, and if we can establish a lot of organic connections between the Synoptics and John, which you can, and moreover, if you factor in that John is writing from a unique perspective as the beloved disciple, he might know more than the other disciples. He might have been privy to some inner teaching that the other disciples were not privy to. So maybe that explains the longer discourses, the greater detail on certain points of theology and doctrine and so on, right? Again, what is your approach? Is it guilty until proven innocent or innocent until proven guilty? Yes.
James Shelton makes the argument that based on the detail in Revelation and the gospel of John was a priest. Do you think that's a reasonable argument, or is that a stretch?
Yeah, Chilton was a postmillennialist and a preterist, so he thought that a lot of the material in the Gospels and elsewhere related to the fall of Jerusalem and did not relate to the end of the world. In terms of was John a priest, I don't know. I don't have an opinion about that. You have to talk to Craig Blomberg. I think that's a novel or pretty minority viewpoint. Yeah.
In Blomberg's book, he talks about two different types of retelling history that existed. One being German, I think it's history, or history, and that would be more like a police report, something that was given very factual, very just event for event. And then there's another type called geschichte that it gives more of the meaning behind the history. The argument that John's gospel is more of the latter, but it is still a retelling of history.
Right, definitely, because the writers do have a theological perspective. They have a worldview, and they're writing in order to recount the acts and the meaning of Jesus. That's why they're writing. I. Howard Marshall wrote a book in 1970 called Luke, Historian and Theologian. Now, you can be a theologian and a historian and be true in both dimensions. Just because you have a theology doesn't mean your history is false. I mean, that is the assumption of a lot of higher critics. If there's a theological framework, structure, development argument, it can't be history. Well, that just begs the question of whether God exists and whether these writers have a true perspective. You know, you really need to think in terms of worldviews when you do apologetics, just in every aspect of life. You have to think in terms of worldviews, presuppositions, assumptions, what people bring to the table, what they bring to the text. So, okay, Luke has a theological perspective, and he writes history. John has a theological perspective. It's within the framework of history. But he's trying to show the significance and the meaning of the events. Now, if he is a disciple of Jesus, and as we will argue, if Jesus is a supernatural being, a unique and unrepeatable being, then it could very well be that these stories are true stories. And that with some work, some effort, you can come up with plausible ways that they relate to each other. You know, that you have the synoptic problem and how those Gospels relate to each other in terms of their sources and their styles and so on. Then you have how the synoptics relate to John, because John is quite different in many ways. But there's still a lot of commonality between the synoptics and John, and of course between the synoptics. And again, what's your methodology? Guilty until proven innocent, or innocent until proven guilty? Now, I think given sort of a general reliability argument, from the early dating of the books and from the claim that they're eyewitnesses or those that consulted eyewitnesses, and you have extra-biblical corroboration with Tacitus, Suetonius, and so on, Thales, and you have some archaeological confirmation, and if you've already given an argument for the existence of God, or several arguments, so miracles are possible, and if the miracle stories are not good enough to be fakes, the C.S. Lewis argument. Also, J.B. Phillips gave that argument in a book of his called The Ring of Truth. And he was well familiar with mythical and legendary literature as well, things that everybody knows are mythical and legendary. There's no debate about it. Then when you put all these things together, and then you invite people to read the text with an open mind, or if they're theists, to pray, God, if this is... Now, this is not the Mormon chop. God, if this is your word, will you show me? Will you show me that it is true? I don't eliminate that aspect of Christian witness or Christian conversion at all. Okay? But you don't rest everything on that. If you can have a warm, fuzzy feeling about a text, then it's a crock. But if the Holy Spirit really quickens the truth to your soul, that's something very different. And if it is the truth quickened to your soul, and it makes sense, then you don't have to turn your mind off as you grow in your faith. One of the things I told the students last night was, shouldn't a religion allow you to think critically about reality? I didn't put it in those words. I kind of like those words. You always come up with the better chops the night after. But shouldn't a religion allow you to think critically about reality? Because a lot of people are saying, well, it's beyond words, it's beyond the mind, it's beyond logic. So no, that part of you has to be brought into your orientation to spirituality, not left aside, not shunted off into the corner. if it's going to address you as a whole person. Nevertheless, I do not by any means diminish or marginalize the witness of the Holy Spirit answering to the truth of the Bible. But you see, you don't have to convince someone of biblical inerrancy to get them to read the New Testament. You just argue that there's some good reasons to believe it's reliable. There are some stupendous and momentous claims made in the New Testament about Jesus, about our destiny with relationship to Jesus, about world history, and so on. Wouldn't you like to investigate this? And what you can say is, why don't you read this, think about it, and if you have questions or worries or complaints, write them down and talk to me about it. And if I don't have an answer, I'll go to one of my professors, or I'll read a book, or I'll do something. So you're kind of putting the burden on the other person. Investigate, and if you have difficulty believing this, you tell me why, and let's talk about it. You know, because people have a lot of stock phrases. We've already talked about one of them. You can't believe the Bible because it's been translated so many times. All right, we dealt with that. Another one is you can't believe the Bible because it contradicts itself. So the question to then ask is, could you please tell me where it contradicts itself? Some people won't even have an answer to that. Some people have a lot of things, and you'll have to do some work. You have to haul out some good study tools, maybe Gleason Arger's book, Encyclopedia of Biblical Difficulties, good work on the synoptic problem, whatever it may be. I mean, you have to spend some time in the woodshed on this. But in some cases, people will use, you can't trust it because it contradicts itself, as a kind of mantra in exchange for critical thought. So what you need to try to get them to do is to engage the material carefully and critically and thoughtfully and with openness. And what's behind a lot of the radical criticism is speculation and anti-supernaturalism and, thirdly, a penchant for the sensational. Now, this has to do with the plausibility structure. This is not an ad hominem argument against them. But this is a word to the wise with respect to the plausibility structure of American culture, American media culture. Now, one reason why the Jesus Seminar raised such a fuss 5 or 10 years ago was that they were coming up with something outside of the mainstream, something different, something radical, something novel. They were color-coding the Bible, and it wasn't just read for Jesus' words. You see? And they had a marketing strategy. Now, it's not news in American media to say that Reverend Jones preached on the literal resurrection of Jesus this Easter. Oh, wow! That's news! Front page, you know? But if a bunch of self-appointed radical New Testament scholars get together and color code the sayings of Jesus, where the entire Gospel of John is not the spoken words of Jesus. There's nothing in the Gospel of John that Jesus spoke. Well, that's news. That's how this whole thing works. So basically, the innovators, the radical critics that are coming up with new and different ways of tearing apart the Bible, are newsworthy. And the people that are siding with 2,000 years of church history are boring. That's just the way it's set up. Now, a lot of people don't know this. And a lot of people only ride on the froth of culture. They don't dig deep. They don't do research. They don't really think about it. So they read these articles. They didn't bring my drumsticks. They see these things on television, right? Now, occasionally, you'll get a conservative scholar on one of these television programs. But they're boring, right? Because they have nothing new. Now, they're not boring because they're wrong, because they're stupid, because they give bad arguments. They're boring because this is 2,000-year-old news. So if you have Daryl Bach or Craig Blomberg or Ben Witherington saying, well, I believe it's reliable for this reason, for that reason. Oh, yeah, you know, people have been saying it's reliable for 2,000 years. Next. Then you have Dominic John Crossan coming up there saying, well, I think Jesus was buried in a shallow grave and his body was eaten by dogs. Wow! Wow, what a thought. What a movie that would make. It's tremendous. It boggles the mind. You know, and then people run around saying, well, you know, Jesus' body was buried in a shallow grave and eaten by dogs. That's news. That's exciting. So people get these ideas about the Bible, religion, and Jesus oftentimes for what I call the froth of culture. And what is bizarre and odd is newsworthy and gripping and sensational and spectacular. And then what the church has been defending for two millennia is ho-hum, yawn, big deal. We've heard that before. We want something new. So you've got to kind of battle. This is my TV stage. I just realized that. You have to battle that sensibility when you talk to people. Now, I'm not giving you the full-fledged argument. We have such good people here in the New Testament that can go so deep into these things, the different types of criticism, source criticism, form criticism, redaction criticism, and all the rest of it. And Craig Blomberg's really a world-class scholar in this issue. And whenever I try to write anything on it, I always give it to him so he takes out the stupid things that I put in there so I can have a passable argument. He's the expert, I'm not. But you don't have to be a Craig Blomberg to defend the reliability of the gospel. You just have to have some basic arguments, some basic understanding, and some skills, relational skills, with people who have questions or doubts or misconceptions. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, we should be fearless, really. Not, we can't read every critical thing, every non-Christian piece of literature that comes out. But if something is in the news, it's getting people's attention, and you're hearing a lot about it, let's say the Da Vinci Code or something like this, you should at least have a basic grasp of what's going on in the document so you can respond to it intelligently instead of just saying, well, I know it's not true because the Bible's true. You need to be able to internally look at that. In my book, Jesus in an Age of Controversy, I have a little chapter on the Jesus Seminar. This came out originally in 96. That was the second edition, actually, of a previous book, a revised edition. At that point, this was still very much in the news. And I just went through. They list their presuppositions in the introduction to that book. They have, I think, six or seven presuppositions, and they're all bogus. So you go through the presuppositions and you show it doesn't fit the best modern scholarship or its methodological naturalism, and that basically undermines their whole project. And when you realize that they are not a representative sample of modern scholarship at all, they're the most liberal of the liberal. But I think as Christians, we need to be grounded enough intellectually and morally and spiritually, and we have to have enough of a passion for reaching the lost with truth communicated rationally, that we read these other sources once in a while. That we look into these arguments. Now, not everybody's going to write books on apologetics or give classes on it. But, for instance, before this talk I did on Jesus and Buddha, and I've given that talk many times in many different settings, but I always like to retool a little bit. So I bought two magazines written from a Buddhist perspective, Shambhala Sun and Dharma Journal, I think it is. So I bought those, I looked through them, I tried to read the most intellectually kind of challenging articles about Buddhism. So I just wanted to be kind of in the Buddhist world a little bit. And when I do that, I pray beforehand. I don't want to get off track. I don't want to get spiritually slimed by doing that. But I think I need to know what's going on. And frankly, after being a Christian for 28 years and all that I've done, I'm really not afraid of these things. And so why not? You get some basic tools, some basic chops, you spend some time in the woodshed, you have your arguments down, then why not read those books or parts of them, or at least be conversant, be cognizant with what they're saying, especially when people are talking about these things on campus, in letters to the editor, online, in the church, wherever it is. And I hope that if you're not to that point now, that you'll get there, really. That you'll read broadly within the Christian tradition on apologetics, theology, biblical studies, ethics, and so on. But you'll begin to read the unbelievers' attacks and what the arguments are on the other side. So you know for yourself. You don't just know what Josh McDowell said about the unbelievers' argument. You know what they actually said because you've read some of them. Yes, Finn? I wouldn't waste my time on that. Serious books is what I'm talking about. Well, sometimes you have to read books that are just terrible because so many other people are reading them. Yeah. So maybe so. If you really want to take that on and you think it's a worthy project, you might want to read one of those books and critique it. You trying to throw me off?
No, I think that's
yes, you are.
I thought maybe you'd go up on the platform again.
No. I get out my drumsticks, though. All right, well, let me do a little bit of comparison. Questions or comments? There's a lot more in JP that I didn't deal with, and in Moreland, of course, Blomberg's got so much great material on this. He's got a book called Historical Reliability of the Gospels, 1987. His newer book is called Historical Reliability of John, came out in 2002. Great material. Yes?
Well, there's two things. One, I found that people that discount the Bible discount it as a book, and that the Bible, they picture the Bible itself as one complete story.
Right.
And not, if you just take the Gospels, those are four individual biographies from people that didn't really know each other. Had no corroboration. If in today's terms we had four biographies about somebody, nobody would doubt whether or not that person existed.
Yeah, well, it's only the really radical people that claim Jesus never existed. I mean, usually people think he existed, but they doubt he claimed to be divine or doubt he rose from the dead. Now, there is an organic relationship between the synoptics that this diagram lays out. So Luke knew about Mark, certainly. Whether Matthew knew about Luke or Luke knew about Matthew, we're not sure about that. We have to reconstruct that. So there are organic literary relationships there, but you still have four distinct documents written by four people for different purposes. Another thing that's very important with supposed contradictions between the Gospels is what was the literary intention of the author, right? And what are they really targeting? For instance, John is the only Gospel that talks about the resurrection, not resurrection, the raising of Lazarus, right? So a lot of critics have said, well, if that really happened, all the Gospels would have talked about it because it was so profound, so dramatic. So even a friend of Christian theism, like Richard Swinburne in his book, The Resurrection of God Incarnate, says that he thinks that John 11 is probably a theological discourse that's not rooted in history because the synoptic don't mention that. So I read that. I went back to Blomberg's book. And he has like one little paragraph explaining it. It has to do with the editorial intentions of the authors, that the synoptics were not concerned with that part of Jesus' ministry. And they record other raisings of the dead, so they believe in it. It's like one little paragraph, and you just solve that problem. And it's really a very satisfying answer. So you've got to look at the nature of the documents, the literary purpose as best we can understand it, the extant tradition of who wrote the documents. Remember that line from Lewis, oftentimes the critics are too busy reading between the lines to read the lines themselves. And if they have methodological naturalism at the basis of all their criticism, the results are assured. You'll have a non-supernatural book and you'll have a non-divine Jesus. But if you open up the discourse to the possibility of revelation, the possibility of miracle, and really look at these documents in terms of when they were written, who wrote them, extra-biblical corroboration, their internal integrity, the claims they make, and the worldview that they communicate, right? The worldview they communicate, that there is a personal and moral God who communicates to human beings, who organizes history for his purposes. You factor all those things together, you have a very strong case for the reliability, the trustworthiness of Scripture, and you try to incite people to investigate. And I think you should incite them to investigate with some kind of a plan for follow-up, if at all possible. Read this. Think about this. If you don't believe something, if you don't understand something, let's talk about it. If I can't answer the question, I'll try to find someone else who can. But any question is legitimate. I think that is very freeing and refreshing to people. So many people have been told for so long that you have to read the Bible and you either believe it or you don't. You ever heard that? The Bible. You just believe it or you don't. You just choose to believe it or you don't. That's a paucity of categories. You may read the Bible and not know whether it's true or not, and you're investigating it. You may have very significant, important questions about the Bible, and the questions need to be addressed. All right, questions or comments before I make a few, very few comments about Gnostic materials and Buddhist scriptures in comparison. Yes? Who? I don't know about videos. any video I don't know anything about. Oh, he's trying to find the ark on Ararat? Oh, Sinai. Okay. No, I haven't heard of that. But, you know, it's a very interesting point to make. If you talk about the Bible with relation to the other religious or sacred books of the world, nobody goes to the Bhagavad Gita to get clues as to where to find archaeological artifacts. Nobody goes to the Upanishads. Nobody goes to the Pali Canon of Buddhism. Nobody goes to the scriptures of other religions, basically, except the Bible, the Old and New Testaments, to find clues as to what happened in the ancient world. Because the Jewish and Christian faiths are deeply historical. It's intrinsic, embedded in the worldview. God is a God who created the universe and is in charge of history. And he reveals himself in history. Space, time, datable events with significance. And that these events have been recorded and interpreted truly and wisely for us in these books. You look at the Bhagavad Gita, you look at these other scriptures, they're supposedly wise sayings or grand mythological stories and so on, they have a very different tenor, a different feel than what we have in the Bible. The Book of Mormon makes historical claims, but very, very little evidence to back them up. We have historical claims and a good deal of evidence to back it up. All right, now, what's really the rage, I talked about this a little bit last time, I've written a lot about the Gnostic Gospels over the years, but I want to just be very brief here. The appeal of the Gnostic Gospels is not rooted in historicity. The appeal of the Gnostic Gospels is rooted in their avant-garde worldview. Again, it's the sensationalism. It's the appeal to spectacle. And no one has done a better job of promoting this than Elaine Pagels. Interestingly, one of the Buddhist magazines I purchased had an interview with Elaine Pagels. They really liked her. Because her view of Christianity is actually closer probably to Buddhism than it is to Christianity. Jesus as a teacher of wisdom, a teacher of secret mysteries, that the divine is really within the self. That's Mahayana Buddhism or Zen. It's not Theravada Buddhism. In any event, the notion is... I heard a strange sound. I think it was applause. The notion is that the early church basically suppressed certain documents, these Gnostic interpretations of Jesus, where Jesus is a illuminated illuminator, and he helps other people to become illuminated, to find the secret wisdom or gnosis within themselves. The world of matter, space, and time has to be transcended. That's the result of a lower-level deity, a demiurge. The cosmology gets very, very complex. But the notion is there is some divine element or spark within the human, and this can be fanned into flame, so to speak, by the mysterious teachings of Jesus. He's not the crucified and resurrected Savior of the world. He's certainly not God incarnate, because given the Gnostic view of matter, you don't want to incarnate into it. You want to escape from it. Now, these documents all date to the 2nd and 3rd centuries. The most plausible candidate for a legitimate gospel is the Gospel of Thomas. That's a collection of 114 sayings or logions that have no narrative context. And a good deal of them overlap with what we have in the Gospels. I think it's mostly the Synoptic Gospels. So we have some dominical sayings, some sayings from Jesus. But then we have others that are completely out of character from the worldview of the Bible. And scholars have done a lot of work on what's the relationship of Thomas to the Synoptics and John and all the rest of it. But I think the best arguments are that this is a second century document because we don't have any outside attestation to the Gospel of Thomas until I think sometime in the third century. I've got it in one of my books and I forgot what I wrote. It's late. It's quite late. It's not like the rest. It's not like the books of the New Testament that are pretty much all discussed by 100-110 A.D., with the exception of a couple of books like Hebrews and Revelation. Moreover, when you compare the structure, the nature of the Gospel of Thomas, it's just a series of sayings. There's no narrative context to it. That is completely unlike the Gospels that have narrative. It's all contained in stories. In fact, I once interacted with a cult group that used the Gospel of Thomas as their sacred text. And that was all they really used. And they gave the group, the group gave meaning to the text as the cult leader told them to interpret the book. The group was called the Christ Brotherhood. They were in Eugene, Oregon in the early 80s. And they eventually broke up. The leader, Patterson Brown, who had been, interestingly, a good analytic philosopher in the 1960s, he became a cult leader. That's a philosophy I'll do to you. Became a cult leader and was sent to jail for statutory rape. They had some very novel views of sexuality. But I remember talking to them once with my friend Ben Johnson, who was a sociologist of religion, not a Christian. We went over to their house, and they gave us this real lavish meal, trying to court us, because I was being contacted by media about this group because I was kind of the local cult expert, and Ben Johnson was a sociologist of religion. And I asked them point blank about justification by faith. Do you believe that Jesus came to die for our sins, and by trusting in Him that we receive salvation, everlasting life? And the leader, actually the main leader was in jail at that time, but the second leader just got livid. Said, that is not what Jesus taught. I thought, okay, I understand this group now. That's what you do with any group. Just give them the gospel and see what they say to it. That was a pretty good indicator of what they were all about. Anyway, they took the Gospel of Thomas. I think the group is now disbanded. But the issue here, again, is more popular appeal than it is historical integrity. When you read the Gnostic documents, they are not that concerned with history anyway, because they believe that the whole space-time continuum is a terrible mistake by a demiurge. You want to get the heck out of here. They don't really care that much about historical facts. They're sort of retelling stories with a different worldview. There's an extant Jesus tradition that they take as authoritative, and then they try to reinterpret it with an entirely different worldview, a dualistic worldview. I go into a lot more detail on this in my book, Jesus in an Age of Controversy. Yes?
You said that she said that this gospel was suppressed. Is there proof for that, or is that something she's going to be?
Well, you know, there were canonical judgments made later on in church history where they said that these gospels are not legitimate gospels. But they were already in existence. They were already circulating, of course, much later than the real Gospels, the canonical Gospels, and they were considered non-canonical, and I think some of them were destroyed, because at the Nag Hammadi find in Egypt in the late 1940s, there were entire documents that were unearthed for the first time. So at some point in church history, they had been suppressed. But simply because they had been suppressed doesn't make them legitimate. I mean, we don't talk about suppressing documents today as something positive to do. But it could be that a bogus second or third century document is suppressed and it's still a crock. People don't think about these things. Oh, suppressed. The church suppressed it, see? It must mean they were afraid of it. And it must mean that these documents must give the hidden story, the inner story of Christianity you haven't heard. This is how this story has been going for 25 or 30 years. And it keeps going. And I say, wait a minute. All right, these Gnostic Gospels are exciting, jazzy, sexy, whatever you want to call them. But do they have any historical credibility? Are they really in better shape than the canonical Gospels with respect to space-time history, verifying authorship? The second and third centuries, you know, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Peter, all this stuff, this is clearly not the authors. Okay? Whereas Matthew, Mark, and Luke, John, we have really strong argument those were the actual authors. Not airtight, there's some question, but given the principle of prescription, we've got those people, they were in the know. Could go on a lot more about this, but if you run into people that are really taken with any of the Gnostic materials, especially Thomas, then just try to press them about the nature of the document, the age of the document, who wrote it. Nobody believes Thomas wrote the Gospel of Thomas, by the way. No one believes that. There's no argument for that whatsoever. It's just called that. Okay? All right, just a point about the Buddhist scriptures that I made last night. It's interesting to me that people can be so fascinated with the Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha, the example of the Buddha, and basically believe that what we have is pretty much accurate to what he said, when the first Buddhist documents come 500 or 600 years after his death. And I don't get that from some Christian apologist. I get that from Edward Kahn's, the Buddhist scholar. And I've got the quote in On Jesus. I made to that point last night. You know, the Gospels that we have are written 30 or 40 years, maybe 50 years after the time of Christ. The Buddhist scriptures about 500 to 600 years. Now, did they have a strong oral tradition? Sure they did. But still, 500 or 600 years? If you're so interested in the literature of Buddhism and you think we know something about the historical Buddha, then you have no reason to derogate the material we have on the historical Jesus when you have just a few decades, not several centuries. So it's basically just a fairness kind of an argument.